You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, restaurants in Wisconsin cities are creating connections with nearby farmers. We'll find out more from the author of a new book about Madison restaurants and the personal connections formed between chefs and farmers. Now, if you're hoping to hit the sledding hills this winter, you can learn some science lessons along the way. Hopefully those lessons will be about physics, not anatomy, from those bumps and bruises. We've got you covered, and we can offer some advice that can help you avoid a blistering run like this holiday legend.
Going for a new amateur recreational saucer sled land speed record, Clark W. Griswold Jr.
Remember, don't try this at home, kids. I am a professional.
Later, dudes. Later, rip, hang pen.
Chris Stockdale is an associate professor and assistant chair of the Marquette University Physics Department. Chris, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for letting me join. How are you doing?
Good. Well, as I understand it, your usual work involves detecting signals from supernovas in other galaxies. What leads you to look closer to home for some illustrative physics examples on the hills?
Yeah, just kind of when you see the snow out there, you just feel like you got to go slide. So it's just something that you got to have the home covered as well as like the megaparsecs away.
Now, one key lesson, of course, a big part of this is friction. What kind of lessons can we learn about friction and avoiding it as we're going down the slopes?
Well, the friction's actually not too bad. What's happening when you're sledding is you're kind of melting that little top layer of the snow, and so you're sliding on almost like a little layer of water between you and the sled and the snow. So generally the friction's pretty low, assuming it's pretty smooth. And then if you've got bumps or, you know, if people have been down and there's lots of divots, then you're going to have ice forming, and it's not going to be a little harder if you don't have that snowpack right there. So as long as you've got like a good snowpack there, you're doing fine. Once you start getting ice forming and all that stuff, then the sliding motion doesn't quite melt the ice as quickly as it does the snow. So then you're going to get some bumps.
So our best bet is to be the first one to hit the slopes after that fresh snow?
Yeah, be the first one to hit the slopes, or at least if you've got depending on the kind of sled you've got, you can kind of spread that out a little bit. So if you've got like one of those toboggans, whether it's a wooden one or whether it's a plastic one, they've got a big base along the bottom. And if you just lean left or right, you can steer. That gives you a lot of coverage to spread things out. And you're not too centered in. You want to have something that's pretty durable, because if you're not the first person to go down that hill, you're going to hit some rough patches. And if you've got one of those bigger inflatables, you might be able to, the vinyl ones, they tend to, they can be pretty helpful and, kind of cushioning your bump a little bit, giving you a little bump. If you've got just a rigid sled, then you're probably going to hit those bumps. You're going to feel those bumps a lot more.
Now, suppose someone with, more flexibility and younger bones than I have wants to catch some air. What's the spot we're looking for to get a jump?
Well, it depends on you're going to need a spot there where you can get a little bit of a ramp going up or some kind of bump there. But if you're like a moguls or something like that, if you're just going down a straight hill, not too bad. But if you want the jumps, I'd go with something that's probably going to let you get up a little higher. So if you get, probably not a big, obviously not a big toboggan or something like that. Maybe one of those flexible flyers, the round ones, little discs, those can get you probably some good bumps because you're limiting your contact there. They're harder to steer maybe, but you're probably going to get a better chance of getting a lift than a longer, bigger sled.
Now, how about weight distribution? One big person or a couple people on a sled? Are we trying to spread out as much as we can?
I'd spread it out because if you're going one way or the other, you're going to snowplow somewhere. So if you spread it out, it makes it a little more even, keeps the force on all parts of the sled a little smoother, so you're not kind of likely going to lean. If you start having weight distribution one way or the other, you're going to start maybe tipping the sled either forward, backward, or left, right, and you kind of don't want that unless you do a wipeout, which is fine.
Now, you've got a, this is from a few years back, but you've got a video on YouTube of you explaining some of these physics lessons on a hill in Milwaukee, I believe. Do you have some favorite sledding hills in the Milwaukee area, or do you want to keep them secret so you can be the first one out?
No, I think there's a lot of good ones there. We were out at the one which is over there coming down off of Lafayette, I think, along the lake, right near where there's the coffee shops right across the street. That was a nice spot. Any spot where you have, where you've got a nice long slope down and you're not running into traffic or right into like a fence or something like that. Because you don't want to, as you were listening to the Clark W. Griswold there, you don't want to be, you don't want to bottom out into the lakefront drive or something like that. That would not be good.
And you got to be honest with me here, Chris. As you're whizzing down a hill, are you carefully thinking about the mass and acceleration and the physics equations, or are you thinking about how you're going to stop safely at the bottom?
I'm just having fun. I'm hopefully that I'm just not going to crash somewhere. You get older, a lot younger, maybe you didn't worry quite as much. Once you start getting older, you're like, don't want to end up having to go to the emergency room with this one.
So. Good lesson. Chris, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me join you. And hopefully in the next couple of weeks, we'll have a little more snow up there so we can go out and hit the slopes.
Excellent. That's Chris Stockdale, associate professor and assistant chair of the Marquette University Physics Department, talking with us about the science behind sledding. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story from 2019 about a unique ice fishing tournament in Luck, Wisconsin.
Classic Wisconsin winter activity is making its way into the world of high school sports. Ice fishing teams are popping up in schools across the state. Taylor Pomisol recently threw on her parka to meet some of the student fish wranglers.
It's the first high school ice fishing tournament of the year. Coaches are distributing bait. Student fish wranglers are driving out onto the ice via four-wheeler to find the perfect fishing spot.
It's one of those things that if you do it as a kid, you start to do it as an adult and you can carry it on. Mm-hmm. It's just one of those things that a kid should get the opportunity to do.
For these students, winter means spending time outside for a more non-traditional high school sport. Wendy Dahlman is the president of the Wisconsin Interscholastic Fishing Association and the head coach of Prairie Farm. She says high school ice fishing teams started in 2012, but there are already more than 1,200 students and 100 schools involved statewide.
This sport is growing every year, so it's pretty cool to see. As you drove in, you could see the amount of trailers and trucks and buses and whatnot in the parking lots.
Though the high school competition is new, schools across Wisconsin are getting involved. Jack Springett is in his second year at Amory High School.
It's different. Nobody does it, so why not? Mm-hmm. It's fun.
And sophomore CJ Peterson is hoping Somerset's new team can make an impactful debut.
Hopefully you can do good this year. Hopefully you place in top 20 schools.
Preparation for the Saturday tournament starts the week before. Teams are packing and organizing bait, while organizers check ice and prepare prizes. On the day of the tournament, students get up early and head to the lake. Michaelin Christensen is in her second year at Prairie Farm.
I got woke up at 5:30, and I laid in bed until 6.
Prairie Farm junior Briley Hansen says the day starts with finding the perfect spot to drill and set bait.
You find the depth, bring it up a couple feet, set the minnow on, and then set the tip up.
Oh, guys, you got tip up.
The excitement and challenges.
You cut two already.
Don't stop until the fish are collected and the winner is determined. The season starts at the end of December and can go into March. Since the tournaments are on Saturdays, many students can balance their love of fishing and the outdoors with a school sport.
We're also in basketball, but this is like on the weekends and it's just a lot of fun. You get to spend time outside with your friends and a lot of time we just sit in a heated shack and enjoy fishing while warm.
Dolman says being on the ice can teach people about balance, conservation, and natural resources. It also gives students with different backgrounds a chance to compete together. Most teams don't require any experience to join.
Well, I had two girls out here that never handled an ice auger before, and they both drilled their own hole and set their own tip up. So,
parents are also encouraged to enjoy a day on the ice with their fish wranglers.
And what a great bonding experience for families to get out with their kids and you know, just be in the outdoors.
Christensen's dad, John Barthman, says the family's love of fishing and great memories on the ice make the cold Saturday mornings worth it.
Sometimes she teaches me, sometimes I teach her.
In the future, the sport hopes to expand throughout the Midwest and create more regional tournaments. A middle school component is being considered for the state.
That story was produced by Taylor Pomisel, a Wisconsin Public Radio intern based in Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, we'll find out how a city's restaurant culture can extend to the farmers and food producers that supply them. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. A city's food culture extends far beyond the walls of its restaurants. The connections between chefs, farmers, food producers, distributors, and customers are a big part of the character of a community. Our guest knows those relationships in Madison intimately and wants to help us understand why it matters where our food comes from. Lindsay Christians is a food editor and arts writer for the Cap Times and author of the new book, Madison Chefs, Stories of Food, Farms, and People. Lindsay, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, how would you describe the Madison food scene to people who are not familiar with the area?
I would describe the Madison food scene as being very connected to the farms that are around us. So one of the biggest influences on the chefs that I profiled in this book is the Dane County Farmers Market, which is the largest producer-only farmers market in the country. And the relationships between the chefs and some of these very specific farms are sort of, that's sort of what drove my interest in the book to begin with.
And you write that, you know, there was a big trend that came up on the coast some years back of this farm-to-table local food kind of stuff. It was kind of a natural for an area like South Central Wisconsin.
Absolutely. And I would say that the trend of farm-to-table, if we want to call it that, it was almost simultaneous with L'Etoile here in Madison, Wisconsin. It came up right around the time of Chez Panisse and Alice Waters. So the connections were always there. I do think that the term farm to table has been a little bit greenwashed, which is to say you see a lot of people using it that don't really practice it anymore. But I do think that connection of, you know, getting things from this local food shed and then making really wonderful things with it is something that has very deep roots in Wisconsin.
Yeah, and you meant just use the word connection, and that seems like a real running theme in this book. It's not just this chef, this restaurant buys stuff from this farmer. They really seem to know each other, and they're talking about what are you growing or what cheese are you making or whatever. Can you talk about just some of those personal connections that are uniting, you know, countryside farmers and producers to these city restaurants?
Oh, for sure. So one of my favorite connections in the book is between Tammy Lax, who is the chef and the owner of Harvest, as well as the Old Fashioned in Madison, and Richard DeWild, who owns Harmony Valley Farm, which is out in the Viroqua area of Wisconsin. They've known each other for decades now. Tammy worked at L'Etoile before she opened Harvest, and she was the forager. So both, that means both literally and more, a little bit more figuratively, right? But she's a literal forager. She goes out into to the woods and she'll find mushrooms and all kinds of wonderful things. But she also has this really close connection with Richard. So for example, if something happens to a crop where it doesn't turn out, or they have extra of something, when you have those close relationships between the farmer and a chef or someone who has a restaurant, they can say, you know what, you've got all these extra peppers, we can take them and we're going to turn them into, you know, this preserved thing, or we're going to turn them into a sauce that we can freeze. They can work together really deliberately. That was also very true for Underground Food Collective, which unfortunately is no longer, but had a huge impact in the Madison area just on, again, those connections between farms and restaurants, and then by extension, the diners who become more accustomed to seeing different varieties of peppers or a preserved garlic that is something where we have an abundance of a certain crop that we can then preserve for dishes long to come after that.
I'm really curious about, you've observed a lot of these chefs and their farmers at work. If I open a restaurant, and I'm not gonna. But if I open a restaurant, my specialty is broccoli soup, and I'm always gonna have broccoli soup. But that means I'm committed to getting broccoli, whatever the season, whatever the state is. How do these chefs kind of flex their recipes and change what they serve to say, hey, we're not always gonna serve the same thing. We're gonna serve the best that's out there right now.
So one of the restaurants that really worked with this in a really deliberate way is Salvatore's Tomato Pies. There's a Salvatore's in Sun Prairie is where they opened, but then there are also locations now in Madison and Monona as well. Salvatore's is a pizza place, right? So you can you have your sort of standard pizzas that you always are going to have. And Patrick DiPulo, who's the owner there, he knows that he's going to need X amount of this like locally milled flour, then also with other kinds of flour mixed in there. But he's sourcing locally on some of these core ingredients that he has. So like the burrata and some of the mozzarella cheese and things that they have there. But then what is actually on top of the pizzas, he has some that are really intensely seasonal, and you'll see, you know, more root vegetables or things like that in this time of year than you will maybe in other parts of the year. But he's using the pizza almost like a canvas. Like this is a stable part of it. A consistent thing, but then what's going to go on the top of it, maybe he's going to use microgreens from Vitruvian Farms in McFarland, or he's going to use, you know, certain peppers or mushrooms or other things that he's either finding at the market or preserving. And I think having that consistent element as well as the flexible element is really important if sourcing locally is important to you and you happen to have a restaurant in the upper Midwest where it is winter a good chunk of the year. You really have to be flexible.
Talking to Lindsay Christians, author of the new book, Madison Chefs, Stories of Food, Farms, and People. We're talking about the connections that chefs make with farmers and other food producers and distributors. One story that struck me, Lindsay, and I think this is L'Etoile, a restaurant in Madison, in the early days, going out to local farmers, realizing our restaurant's too small to, you know, pay the farmers enough money to keep the supply going. So actually helping them make connections with bigger Chicago restaurants. It was in their self-interest to help other restaurants tap into the same source lines.
Yeah. The thing with local food and sourcing locally in a really deliberate and consistent way, you have to be, as we sort of said, more flexible. But then there's also the issue of quantity. So no one restaurant usually is going to be able to buy all of the squash that a farm grows. For one, like it's all coming kind of at the same time or around the same time, right? So you also have to have other restaurants that are on board with that, on board with the unpredictability a little bit. Like there's a chance that if you're a broccoli soup restaurant and all the broccoli, you know, gets a disease or is flooded out or something happens, right? That you have to be flexible that way. But also just being able to say, you're going to grow this many onions. We can only take this many because this is the size of our restaurant. So we need to have more of a collaborative, more of a collective commitment to supporting these farms and to saying that this is an important way of how we want to eat and how we want to not only develop, but sustain a local food shed in that way.
How about on the farmer side of the equation, Lindsay? I mean, one way to farm is to do a lot of a particular commodity, whether that's milk or soy or corn or whatever, sell it to one big supplier, know that they can count on usually selling it to that one big supplier. Are there a lot of farmers out there willing to kind of custom make and mix and match for these local restaurants?
Yeah, so there are pros and cons of diversity, right? I think we know about the pros. You know, you have a lot of different kinds of things. If one crop doesn't work, you've got all the rest of your crop to rely on. But there are also economies of scale that it would be unwise to ignore. If you are really good at growing sweet potatoes or you're really good at growing onions or something like that, it does make sense to do that really well. Say you're going to grow organic onions, do a lot of that. And that's, there's nothing wrong with that. That's not a bad thing. I know a lot of farms do CSA and they talk about that as being like a master's degree in farming, because when you're doing CSA, you really do have to be pretty diverse. But a lot of the restaurants that relied on connections with restaurants, or a lot of the farms that relied on connections with restaurants these past couple years have really had a tough go of it. So CSA has kind of come surging back over the last 2 years because of the pandemic. And I think we're seeing some of those relationships between farms and restaurants shift a bit, and also the value, you know, among diners and eaters for things like CSA go up because of, you know, the supply chain issues that are also affected by the pandemic, right? So I do think it's interesting to think about, if you can do something really well, like one thing, that's not necessarily bad. But making sure that we are sustaining the soil and the things that will allow that to be sustainable is also something important, I think, to keep in mind.
And just our last minute, Lindsay, there's a lot of talk about urban-rural divides in our culture. There's literally been a book written about resentment from rural Wisconsin pointed toward Madison. In looking at these relationships you track in your book, do you see this community that transcends some of those divides that are out there?
I think it does. I think there was a phrase that Therese Allen mentioned early on in our interviews about rooted cosmopolitanism. And I like this idea of us having roots that through these connections with farms, these restaurants that may be in urban areas, can really make those connections, can make those kinds of relationships, and to help us understand each other on both sides.
We'll leave it there. Lindsay, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
Lindsay Christians is a food editor and arts writer for the Cap Times. She joined us today to talk about her new book. It's called Madison Chefs, Stories of Food, Farms, and People. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, American democracy may be more fragile than we think, and intolerance could lead to authoritarianism. That's the message from the author of the new book, It Could Happen Here. And a lawyer who represented farmers in a high-profile lawsuit back in the 80s looks back on the case and says the deck is still stacked against family farms, but she says there are ways to push back. We'll meet the author of the new book, The Farmer's Lawyer. That and more tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then lawmakers on Capitol Hill are preparing to mark the first anniversary of the January 6th attacks on the U.S. Capitol. We'll talk about that and a push to pass national voting rights legislation in Congress. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, some schools across the country, including here in Wisconsin, are going back to virtual learning as Omicron spreads. The majority of districts still in person, though some bumping back the start date. We'll look at what schools are doing 2 years into the pandemic. First, lawmakers on Capitol Hill are planning a series of events for tomorrow's one-year anniversary of the January 6th insurrection. Some early reporting suggests it may be mainly Democrats in attendance. Meanwhile, a press conference from former President Donald Trump that was scheduled for tomorrow has now been canceled. It's a week in Washington. We'll talk about that story and more. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you remember about the attacks on the Capitol last year? Do you want to see lawmakers from both parties come together to reflect on what happened that day? What needs to be done, do you think, to make sure something like that doesn't happen again? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Lauren Gambino is a political correspondent for The Guardian U.S. Lauren, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to start with a listen to Democratic Senator Brian Schatz from Hawaii on the Senate floor yesterday, remembering last year's Capitol attack.
I was here, and by I was here, I don't mean I was here in the Capitol. I mean, I was right here at this desk. And so no one needs to characterize it for me or pontificate about it or tell me what I think happened. I was right here. It wasn't theoretical. It wasn't a debate. It was a physical siege on the United States Capitol.
First of all, Lauren, this anniversary is personal for a lot of the lawmakers, their staff, and the others who were there that day. Can you talk about that a little?
Yes. I mean, this was a day that these lawmakers, you know, they fled for their lives. They didn't know exactly the extent of what was going to happen. You know, they were seeing violence all around them. I mean, this is incredibly, incredibly personal. And plenty of lawmakers, but also, you know, people who worked in the Capitol, they still bear sort of the emotional scars from that day. And certainly the police officers, many of them who defended the Capitol that day, bear physical scars from the violence. And so, you know, I think for a lot of lawmakers, it's very important to them that the memory of this day is preserved accurately. I think we're seeing and hearing, particularly among sort of right-wing conservative media, we're hearing rewrites of the day and what exactly took place, and some attempts to downplay it. Even the former President Donald Trump himself has attempted to downplay or rewrite what took place. And I think all of these efforts, what we'll hear a lot of from President Biden, Kamala Harris, the Democratic leaders in Congress, we're going to hear a lot about the day, and that is an effort to preserve the memory and preserve sort of a historical record of what took place.
What kind of things are being planned in the Capitol for that anniversary tomorrow?
So first, you'll hear from President Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris. We heard from the press secretary today that Joe Biden plans to make very clear that that Donald Trump bears, she said, singular responsibility for this event. It's unclear if he's going to call out the former president by name, but she said it would be very clear who he was talking about. So we do expect that in the morning. And then throughout the rest of the day, there will be remarks from House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. She will hold a moment of silence on the House floor. We'll also actually, I think this is an interesting event. They're going to have historians in conversation with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, just to discuss again the importance of remembering this day so that it doesn't take place again, so that we can learn lessons from it. And then it will close with a prayer vigil on the Capitol steps. So a full day of events tomorrow.
Meanwhile, former President Trump had announced he would be making an address tomorrow in Florida that is apparently canceled now. What do we know about the back and forth on that?
Yeah, Donald Trump had come under pressure, you know, interestingly, from Republicans and conservatives like Laura Ingraham, who thought maybe it's not the best idea for Donald Trump to be holding a press conference in which he would almost certainly rail against Joe Biden, probably revive claims of false claims of the stolen election. And the idea is that, you know, that just doesn't help. Republicans don't want to spend the day being asked if they agree with Donald Trump's false memories of the day. And so he had, you know, become under a lot of pressure to pull out. And so ultimately he did cancel that press conference scheduled for January 6th and said he'd have more to say at a later rally. So it's certainly not the last from him, but we won't be hearing from him, it seems like, on January 6th, at least in the form of a press conference.
It's our weekly look at some of the top stories in national news. Lauren Gambino is with us from The Guardian US. Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Saul is with us in Stevens Point. Saul, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to point out, I'm not in favor of what happened on the 6th, absolutely the opposite. But remember that the mayor of Washington, D.C., because of the overuse of the military during some of the Black Lives Matter displays, begged them to keep the military low-key, keep them invisible. And that's one reason the military wasn't ready to move in. There were a lot of contradictory things going on at the same time.
So thanks for the call. Lauren, we have this ongoing investigation. Is that one of the angles that this House committee is still looking at, the various levels of security precautions taken or maybe not taken leading up to the 6th?
Absolutely. The security failures, I mean, it's been called failures at sort of every level. You know, what happened in D.C., well, you know, all the way up the chain is being investigated by the House Select Committee. Also, the DOJ is looking into what occurred, and then Capitol police officers as well have issued a number of different reports and analysis and given testimony as to what had happened on that day. And we actually just got a recent report from Capitol Police about their preparations, going forward and what has changed and new security measures that have been enacted since. So certainly, certainly this is all a live discussion and part of this ongoing investigation.
Thanks for that call, Saul, at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Tyler next in Wausau. Tyler, hello.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Tyler?
So you were asking what one thing people remembered about the insurrection, and the one thing that kind of always sticks with me to this day is that there was video of Trump supporters tearing down the American flag and replacing it with Trump's MAGA flag. And it just kind of encapsulates at how far these people have, you know, gone to the right and how much they hate America.
Tyler, thanks for the call. A lot of people, Lauren, whether it's that moment or others, looking at the symbolism, the world watching these events in the capital of the United States. Is that something people are still talking about, just what this did to the world's view, to people's view of the United States?
Absolutely. I think, you know, everyone has their image from the day. You know, for me, it's that guy hanging from the Senate, from the, you know, the seats in the upper chamber of the Senate. And I just think, you know, there was, these images were just so shocking. This is the seat of American government, and to see it overrun by rioters, to see the violence, to see, you know, the different flags, the Confederate flag waved in the halls of Congress. It was just very shocking. And I think it exposed, you know, a vulnerability to American democracy like we haven't seen before. And I think sort of that's the vein of the discussion that we're seeing build in on this 1 year anniversary. You know, how do we make sure our democracy is secure? How do we prevent this from happening again? Because it was just so shocking.
Before we move on from this topic, Lauren, we of course have this House committee looking at what President Trump knew, calls for him to take action throughout the 6th. We heard today from Attorney General Merrick Garland talk about an ongoing investigation, saying, quote, the Justice Department remains committed to holding all January 6th perpetrators at any level accountable under the law, whether they were present that day or otherwise criminally responsible. What are you watching for next in investigations from Congress or from the Justice Department?
Well, certainly we're looking at how close they get to Donald Trump's inner circle, to Donald Trump himself. We've heard from members of the committee that they, you know, are finding more and more evidence to suggest Trump didn't take action despite being asked to on the day of that he didn't take action to stop the rioters, that he was asked by his daughter Ivanka, for example, to please intervene. And so I think I'm curious where all of these different threads lead. You know, do they ultimately lead to someone in his inner circle being referred for criminal charges or the president? You know, it's all very uncertain, possibly unlikely, but nonetheless, that's sort of where the discussion is going.
Talking to Lauren Gambino, political correspondent at The Guardian U.S., with us today for a weekly look at some of the top stories in Washington. Coming up, efforts by Democrats to pass a federal voting rights law. You can join in on that at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see something at the national level setting more standards that states have to abide by? Or do you think it's better for states to have more authority over how they handle elections and voting rights? Do you support more access to voting by mail? Or do you want to see that reined in? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our look at the top stories in national politics. Lauren Gambino stays with us from The Guardian U.S. Now, efforts to change voting rights laws in Congress, a Democrat-led initiative. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see something pass? Do you want to see bipartisan cooperation? If it's not there, should Democrats in the Senate figure out a way over or around or through the filibuster? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Lauren, what do Democrats have on the table right now when it comes to voting rights?
They have two bills. One is called the John Lewis Act, and that would restore the Voting Rights Act, pieces of it which were gutted by a Supreme Court decision a few years ago. And then the second one is far more expansive, and that would really change the way we run elections in terms of giving the sort of setting a federal standard, if you will, for how we run elections. It would also have implications for campaign finance. It's pretty sprawling, and Democrats feel very important. They point to this new flurry of state level laws that are sort of rolling back, restricting access to voting. Some of the expansions we saw in 2020, particularly due to the pandemic, so expansions of mail-in voting, those kind of new rules, those are being rolled back. And many of these state level Republican lawmakers are using Donald Trump's false claims of voter fraud as sort of a basis for needing these new laws. So Democrats feel that their bill is really a response to that. But again, it does go further. And that's why there's been such strong debate in the Senate about it. Democrats have just 50 senators. They are trying to get bipartisan support, but as of right now, they certainly do not have anywhere near 10 Republican votes that they would need to overcome a filibuster. So they are more or less stuck. Senator Joe Manchin, always a key figure in the Senate, he has been working to try to find some sort of bipartisan consensus on voting rights, but so far has really not even come close to finding that middle ground. So that's kind of where they are. They're pretty stuck, but they are trying to forge ahead, and they're discussing, you know, different ways of possibly reforming the filibuster to pass this legislation.
I want to give a listen to Republican Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell on that point of Democrats making the case that laws are being eroded in states around the country. Here's a listen to him on the Senate floor today.
The American people are not buying this nonsensical talk of Jim Crow 2.0 or a voting rights crisis. Everybody apart from left-wing activists and the press understands this emperor has no clothes at all.
So doesn't sound like a lot of openness to a bipartisan compromise there from the Senate Minority Leader.
Absolutely not. We're hearing talk from Republicans about, you know, possibly being open to reforming something. You know, it's tangential. They're not really looking directly at voting rights. I think Democrats sort of know that their one way to do this is to try to find some carve out, some change, some rule change to the filibuster in order to just pass this with 50 Democratic votes. But how? But you run into the issue of Joe Manchin and another senator, Kyrsten Sinema, who just don't want to get rid of the filibuster and are really wary of doing anything that might undermine the sort of power of the filibuster, which again requires 60 votes in the chamber.
You mentioned one idea that some conservatives might be on board with. There have been calls to reform, including from some conservative media outlets. The laws related to what happened last year on January 6th, really a ceremonial signing off on the already completed Electoral College count to make it really crystal clear that no, the vice president can't single-handedly block the election of the next president. Does it seem like there's openness to say, hey, let's lock down some clarity on that process?
Absolutely. And that's actually something that the House Select Committee, which will come out eventually with a list of legislative proposals for the Congress to consider. And that is certainly in one of the issues that they're targeting. Let's just make this language very clear so that we have no misunderstandings going forward. We want to know what the role is of the vice president, that it's ceremonial in this function, and we just do not want to have any lack of clarity there. And so I think there is an openness to reform that, but again, that isn't exactly what Democrats are focused on with their voting rights bill. That's a little separate. So this won't satisfy Democrats' urge for voting rights reform, even if Democrats do support making that language clearer.
Talking to Lauren Gambino from The Guardian U.S., looking at some of the top stories in national politics right now, including Democratic efforts to pass some kind of voting rights reform that would apply to all states. Let's bring on a caller on that now. Liz is with us in Waukesha. Liz, hi.
Hi there. I cannot understand for the life of me why the Republican Party would not want to vote for fair and secure elections that prevent voter fraud. Why? What are they thinking? What is going on? It sounds rather devious to me. I think every senator, every House Republican, everyone should want a fair, secure election so that the people win the president that they elected.
Liz, thanks for that call. Lauren, one argument I've seen certainly from Republicans is along the lines of, hey, elections are the state's job to run. We don't want the federal government stepping on toes. What are you hearing from Republicans as to why they don't want to pass these two packages of voting rights bills?
That's absolutely right. And they also argue that expanding access, so perhaps like expanding mail-in balloting, for example, makes it easier for a voter to commit fraud. We haven't seen any evidence of that. But nonetheless, there is this idea that, you know, making it easier to vote somehow makes it easier to commit voter fraud. And that is what many, especially at the state level, have embraced. Again, not a lot of evidence to back that up, but that is one argument. And so in their defense, they're saying, you know, we're actually trying to guard against voter fraud, and that's what these laws do.
Thanks for that call, Liz, at 800-642-1234. Lauren, I want to look at an agenda item for Democrats in Congress that spilled over from 2021. They passed a COVID relief package early in the year, the infrastructure bill, with some Republican support later in the year. That left part three, the Build Back Better Act, a lot of social safety net stuff, climate change, and more. What is happening, or I guess maybe what is not happening with that right now?
I think that's the better question. It's kind of been left twisting in the wind. You know, again, we go back to Joe Manchin. He has said he does not support it, cannot support it, and will not support it in its current form. And, you know, I think just one way to encapsulate this whole debacle that Democrats find themselves in is on this legislation, they can actually move forward. They're using a parliamentary procedure to move forward with just 50 votes, but they don't have Joe Manchin. And yesterday, Joe Manchin said he has not been talking to the president. He hasn't been in negotiations with his fellow Democrats to try to find a consensus plan he could back. And at the same time, Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and the White House were saying, oh no, we're still in negotiations with Joe Manchin. So if they can't even agree on whether they're in or out of negotiations at the moment, I think it's a very long and difficult path ahead for the Build Back Better plan.
Is anybody publicly floating either Manchin or the White House? Okay, how about this as an alternative plan? Or is that just where nothing's going on right now as far as we can see?
As far as we can tell, so there was some reporting that Joe Manchin had sort of offered like his red line to the White House. But then weeks later, he went on Fox News and said he couldn't support what the White House is putting back. So it's unclear if he'll go back to that, to the drawing board, and they'll look at the offer he reportedly put forward to them several weeks ago. You know, we know where his issues are. He's got issues around the child tax credit. And so maybe that's a starting point for negotiations. Maybe they try to pare it down and just focus on climate and then come back to other pieces of the bill. If anything were to pass, it would be very, very stripped down from what it is now.
Lauren, just briefly as we wrap up, what are you watching for? What's a top story you're watching for in 2022?
Well, it's an election year. So certainly we are watching how Democrats try to hold on to their very, very thin majorities in Congress. And as of right now, it is not looking, the landscape doesn't look great for them as we just watch Democrat after Democrat retire from Congress. So that's definitely something I'm starting to keep my eye on and will be watching for the next 11 months, 10 months.
Lauren, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We've been talking to Lauren Gambino, political correspondent at The Guardian US. She was with us today for our weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics. Coming up after the news, we take a look at how schools in Wisconsin and around the country are handling the latest COVID surge as they return from winter break. And we're hoping to hear from you, your personal experience in your community, in your district, in your family. You can get started right now. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Let us know what's happening in your community, what you wish was happening in your district. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.